This week's episode was brought to you by Bea Okay, Marianne Gardner, Jamie Lynn, Wilted Elf Turtle, Wandering Risk, Barrett Hauk, Buel Mio, and Byzantine St. Clair. Thank you, Bea Okay, Marianne Gardner, Jamie Lynn, Wilted Elf Turtle, Wandering Risk, Barrett Hauk, Buel Mio, and Byzantine St. Clair. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that keeps our gargantuan cyborg rabbit kaiju loaded with enough liquid isomorphic beryllium laser emission panels with sufficient luminosity to rival a mid-sized supernova, so we can lure the Mothman out of his hidden lair in the cloud-dense environment he's native to on Jupiter. If you'd like to help us finally catch the Mothman, or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended edition of this episode, but every single one of our weekly episodes stretching back into the era before artificial intelligence secretly replaced your family with robots to spy on you. But not only that, I'll send you a 5x5 high quality extra sticky vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll even get the secret keys to our Discord server, where we share the schematic for the next generation of inflatable wireless camping toasters. If you're enjoying the free version of The Whole Rabbit well enough and would rather save your $5 for a vacuum sealed package of pre-made coleslaw, then please consider giving us a like, subscribe, or even share us with a friend who's also paranoid about the underlying nature of reality. With your continued help, we grow closer to making The Whole Rabbit a liability that the Shadow Masters in the fifth dimension will no longer tolerate. In this week's episode, we discuss the Gnostic and occult themes found throughout the 90s blockbuster classic, The Truman Show. In the 25 years since the film's theatrical release, The Truman Show has continued to draw new interest and inspired numerous fans to dig through its seemingly never-ending list of clever details and hidden content. While much has been said about the film over the years, we focus on the occult symbolism and religious motifs, which make The Truman Show perhaps the best Gnostic-themed film ever made. We begin by unraveling the etymology of character names and quickly move into the Gnostic, Kabbalistic, and Tarot symbolism hidden in plain sight. We discuss Adam Kadmon, the Scarlet Woman, and of course, the Black Iron Prison. In the extended show, we go even deeper into the machinery of Truman's world and find ourselves treading tarot paths on the moon, exploring the Canis Major star system, the lunar womb matrix, and how Truman uses the principles of hermetic magic to cross the abyss, confront God himself, and complete the great work. Fair warning, we go pretty heavy on the Gnostic, tarot, and Kabbalistic symbolism in this episode. We highly suggest listening to our previous show if you'd like a crash course on Gnosticism, our WTF is Kabbalah episode if you'd like to know more about that, and it wouldn't help to Google a diagram of the Tree of Life, which might be helpful in one or two instances. I actually included some links below to help you get to those things. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Was Solomon's temple located?
Where?
On the side of his head.
There.
That's a smart one.
The ark was built in three stories, and the top story had a window to let light in. But how did they get light to the bottom two stories?
How?
They used floodlights.
Oh.
Why did Noah have to discipline the chickens on the ark?
Why?
Because they used foul language.
Come on.
I'm fluent in foul language.
And why didn't they play cards on the ark?
Why?
Because Noah was standing on the deck. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just scrutinize the theological horror stories that a group of heretical Christians create out of a reinterpretation of biblical Genesis, which names the God of Abraham as the bloodthirsty, lady-violating, jealous tyrant murderer that keeps us working at those day jobs every week. Nay. We explore exactly how some of the best Hollywood has to offer took these same ancient theological horror stories and adapted them into celebrated pieces of modern cinema worthy of being called Gnostic Gospels in their own right, because this week, we're exploring one of the most unapologetically Gnostic films ever created, The Truman Show. I'm your host, Hack Rabbit, also known as Luke Madrid. I'm joined this week by the majestic manifester of miraculous magnetism, Mari Sama.
Wow, what an intro.
The merry-making madman, Malachor 5.
Hey, what's up?
And the head-turning harvester of hearts, Heka Astra.
Hello.
All right, so I guess it goes without saying that this is a spoiler warning for the movie called The Truman Show. If you haven't seen it before, this episode might go a little over your head. That being said, watch the movie, then listen to the episode.
I mean, the film's getting on in age at this point. I feel like the real disclaimer comes in when I tell you this episode probably has more jargon about Gnosticism, Tarot, and Kabbalah than perhaps any we've done before. So if you're not familiar with any of that stuff, we explain it, but there's only so far you're going to make it. Let's be real. But for those of you who want to go really deep into The Truman Show, oh, we got a show for you.
Yeah, it's one of those episodes you got to have your nerd glasses on.
Amen. Go.
Good, I wear mine all the time.
As you should. So when The Truman Show came out in 1998, people had mixed feelings. Well, the critics loved it. Some audiences were just not ready to see Jim Carrey in a serious role. Jim, however, says he never accepted a role so quickly. He even took the role for half the amount of pay he was accustomed to. Because of his obligations to Liar Liar and The Cable Guy, going with Jim Carrey meant that production would have to be delayed for as much as a year. Even still, Peter Weir insisted Carrey was the perfect man for the part and spent the better half of that year preparing and having the story's author, Andrew Niccol, doing as many as 16 rewrites. Weir thought Niccol's original version was too dark, and despite the disturbing themes and dystopian undercurrents, Weir managed to transform The Truman Show into a lighthearted comedy. Even with a mixed bag as such, The Truman Show was a critical and financial success. Moreover, the film has proved to have a remarkable staying power, and it continues to garner renewed interest year after year. Many believe this is due to predicting the meteoric rise of reality television as the dominant form of entertainment.
Indeed. Although reality TV has a history stretching all the way back to the 1940s, the first actual quote-unquote reality TV show was The Real World, which premiered on MTV in 1992.
I remember that. I used to watch Seattle.
And then Big Brother came out, which was another hit. The reality TV genre grew steadily throughout the 90s, and The Truman Show came out in 1998, which was just before the cusp of the second boom of reality show popularity that began in 2000, which obviously has lasted decades at this point up until now. Even today, reality shows are a huge hit, and you even see some of the newer iterations of these shows not only be independently produced outside of TV networks, but with an added benefit of having the internet where people can interact with the people on the show. So there's still more to be explored in this genre. It's still super popular at this point. And I think it's because the benefit of this format is obviously the minimal need to hire actual writers for a show. I mean, we've had lots of writer strikes going on, so this is a great way to make some content without needing to pay someone to write it. And it instead relies on natural interactions, and it's mixed with guidance from the producers and or the director. So it's kind of like a fine line. Like, you can let everyone loose and just record them, but that's not going to be much of a show unless you introduce some kind of obstacles or a game show element, or have the director produce some kind of, drama for the contestants to, you know, to kind of stir up the pot, I guess, is what the director's role is in this kind of format.
Now, I tend to believe the rapid commonness of such low-effort entertainment is part of the reason people are quick to dismiss how meticulous and detail-oriented good filmmakers can be. Director Peter Weir and cinematographer Dennis Gassner even researched surveillance techniques for certain innovative shots, and if you look closely, small globe-shaped camera housings are hidden on countless set pieces. It's almost in every shot. I didn't even notice them until somebody else pointed them out. Truman's Ring is one example, actually. It's got a little tiny camera in there. Now, Weir even had the actors create elaborate backstories for their characters' offset lives. Marlon, for instance, has a severe drug addiction because he's sick with guilt for deceiving Truman his entire life. It just doesn't really come up in the film. Laura Linney studied fashion and advertising from the 1950s to develop outfits and poses for her character as Truman's wife. This figurative ocean of small, almost entirely hidden details is important to mention because they demonstrate demonstrate the level of forethought and importance placed upon certain elements of storytelling, all but entirely occult to the audience. Storytelling is an art with thousands of years of time-tested material to draw from, and it's only reasonable that the top-paid storytellers of our time, endowed with better access to information than ever, would use some of culture's most enduring myths as inspiration. Likewise, a filmmaker uses symbolism in the same way a magician does during ritual, to elicit a predictable response from the various levels of the psyche. As such, we should never be surprised to find a few religious Easter eggs thrown in for good measure. Besides, films with Gnostic overtones were all the rage at the time, with blockbuster hits like Pleasantville, Vanilla Sky, Fight Club, 13th Floor, The Ninth Gate, The Matrix, Dark City, and even Eyes Wide Shut. Over the years, others have noticed a great many small, hidden details in The Truman Show. So to keep things fresh, we're going to only briefly mention those and focus on the ones with religious or mythological significance, the ones you may not have noticed. By the end, we hope to convince you that The Truman Show is in fact a Gnostic gospel as much as the ancient ones found in the Nag Hammadi Library.
The interesting thing about the topic of Gnosticism in movies is that there's a ton of movies that talk about it, of course, but The Truman Show is coming at it directly. Within the movie itself, the main character is having a fourth wall break and actually escapes from his world. So as a person who's watching it, there's actually a director in the movie, and then there's actually a director in real life that made the movie that you're watching. So it's like a multi-level fourth wall breaking approach to making fun of the topic that, like, the Matrix is real. You know, that's like a serious action movie take on the idea. Truman Show is just like blatantly like, okay, let's just make a movie about it in an obvious way with Jim Carrey starring in it. And it's a little bit profound in that way, because other movies try to sum up Gnosticism, and The Truman Show kind of just does it, and it seems like it's with ease.
In my opinion, it might even do it better than The Matrix. So why? How? And let's get into it. So when digging for Easter eggs in The Truman Show, people are quick to notice that Truman's first name reflects the sentiment expressed by Christoph, the show's creator, during the intro of the film, that he, as the main character, is unlike the simulated world and people around him. He's truly authentic. He's the one man that is true. This is likely a reference to Adam Kadmon, which is essentially the image that God used to create material humans, and acts as sort of a universal soul for mankind. This is what's being referenced when someone, usually Christ, is referred to as, quote, the Son of Man. Most relevant here, Adam Kadmon is the pure soul as still undiluted or tarnished by interaction with the material world. This is also true of Truman, who, untouched by the outside world, has become a symbol of hope, goodness, and purity for the rest of humanity. It is this same soul image of the Adam Kadmon that the Demiurge and his Archons thirst for so viciously and construct the Garden of Eden to contain it for their own benefit, just like The Truman Show. In regards to Truman's last name, Burbank, most analyses of the film tend to point out that the soundstage in which Sea Haven is situated is likely in Burbank, California, a location known for its film studios. Well, this seems reasonable and straightforward enough. We would be cheating ourselves to not look at the name's etymology. It's a bit obscure, so a few possibilities exist. Bur is an Old English word for manor or even fortress. The word bank, etymologically speaking, can usually be traced back to a bench, a table, or a mound, as it implies a sort of elevation upon which one can rest. A term we would be familiar with in this context would be an embankment, like the pile of sand we find Truman sitting on as he watches the sunset at various times in the film. Taken together, we might find Burbank encodes the idea of a fortress on a hill. The symbolism of a fortress on a hill brings two relevant concepts to mind, one good, one bad.
So to step into a little bit of the good that Luke might be alluding to here, the first Kabbalist is said to be Seth, the third son of Adam and Eve, and that was like the first proper wizard in the Abrahamic line of things. And there's this idea within that school of thought of the posterity of Seth and basically the true mage's way of understanding and using Kabbalah to do good in the world is what's hoped for there.
And this might be hinted at in the opening of the film where Truman is talking into the mirror and he says, "We're going to the top of this mountain, you know, broken legs and all." So he's kind of foreshadowing that he is going to be like Seth. He's going to use magic to make it to the top of the holy mountain, which is the first goal of all great magicians. But to return to the name etymology, just for a moment, it does have to actually do with the mountaintop. In the esoteric system of Kabbalah, an important tool for early Gnostics, the abode atop the mountain or high hill is associated with the essential sephira, Tifereth.
This sphere is also indicated during the on-air interview with Christoph, who explains that Truman was the sixth child considered for the role. And 6 is, of course, the number of Tifereth.
Interesting.
The Seer of Tifereth, a word that means beauty, is arguably the happiest and best placed on the whole Kabbalistic tree of life. It is often considered the, quote, top of the mountain, because it's the middle point between heaven and earth, which is then connected to every other sephira directly, with the exception of Malkuth, the normal material world that we all natively inhabit at the bottom of the tree. So we in Malkuth are cut off from the mountaintop. It's a struggle to get there. Now, there are other sephira between the top and bottom of the tree, but the lower ones are subject to the influence of matter, which to some degree makes them susceptible to unbalanced or evil expressions. The uppermost sections of the tree are places where the individualized ego, separate from God, are incapable of existing. Tifereth gets to have its cake and eat it too. It's the seat of the true self, the true man, or the human soul that remains separate from, but held within, the love and comfort of God's light emanating directly from above it in Kether. This also makes it an apt symbol for dwelling within the Garden of Eden with God present to watch over us. This sentiment is well expressed by Christoph, the Truman Show's creator, who claims that Sea Haven is a perfect world, a world as it should be. It is a place or mode of being that we are cut off from in our banishment from the garden. More esoterically, Hermetic alchemist Poke Runyon once explained Tifereth as the seat or mansion of the true soul, which wears each of our earthly incarnations, or past lives basically, like a single pearl on a string of pearls in a necklace. In this way, Tifereth is our true individual self. To go higher, we would lose the individual part and be presented with the difficult task of giving it up to become one with God, an ordeal known as crossing the abyss. We'll get there later. These ideas about Tifereth are also reflected in the planetary association of the sun, along with the symbol that represents it. The sun is the center of the solar system, as all the other planets orbit around it in the same way everything orbits around Truman. We even see this idea reflected as a motto on a series of archways shortly after Truman, to the chagrin of the producers, catches a glimpse of the actor who played his father randomly on the street one day. The arches read, Unis pro omnibus, omnis pro uno, which means one for all for one. In terms of the solar glyph, this is the circle surrounding the dot. These various ideas associated with Tifereth make sense for Truman Burbank because he is the only true man in the story. He shares in the same energies that earthly life does while being totally cut off from actual earthly life. This culminates in the bad version of what Burbank might mean. A fortress on a hill, once again the etymology of Burbank, may imply that Truman is housed inside what Gnostic science fiction author Philip K. Dick termed the Black Iron Prison. An idea intended to describe the Demiurge and his Archon's hegemonic control over time, destiny, and the material universe. While Philip K. Dick's description of the Black Iron Prison sounds a touch psychedelic, maybe even a little unhinged, his opinion matters here because the Gnostic dystopias of Minority Report, Total Recall, A Scanner Darkly, and Blade Runner all emerged from Dick's vision of this vast, transtemporal prison. He described it thusly.
Once, in a cheap science fiction novel, Fat, a fictional character meant to symbolize Dick himself, had come across a perfect description of the Black Iron Prison, but set in the far future. So if you superimposed the past, ancient Rome, over the present, California, in the 20th century, and then superimposed the far future world of the android Cried Me a River over that, you got the Empire as the supra or transtemporal constant. Everyone who had ever lived was literally surrounded by the iron walls of the prison. They were all inside it, and none of them knew it.
Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
This description of the Black Iron Prison fits perfectly with the Truman Show. Truman is the Gnostic Christ figure, native originally to ancient Rome. The present, which Dick defines as 20th century California, is presented as, well, 20th century Sea Haven, which exists inside of a literal Black Iron Prison reminiscent of Dick's futuristic high-tech dystopian aesthetic. During the scene where Truman is flipping through old family photos with his supposed mother and wife, there's a Polaroid where young Truman can be seen dressed as a clown, presumably on the landing of a stairwell, hands clasped on the banister support bars like a prison cell. Above the photo is written, My Little Clown. This is easy to miss because Weir spent so much time adapting Nichol's original treatment, which he admittedly called depressing. The Truman Show also makes use of another of Philip K. Dick's favorite motifs, where the Gnostic protagonist is called to escape his mundane prison reality by having encountered the, quote, dark-haired woman, after which the weird, otherworldly revelations begin. In the Truman Show, this dark-haired woman archetype is, of course, Sylvia Garland.
Yeah, Sylvia, she kind of breaks her character in The Truman Show, because that's what you're watching in like the first act of the film. She kind of goes on a date with him, and by the end of the date, like when things are getting kind of hectic, she tells Truman, like, people know everything you do. And she's telling him kind of an ultimate truth, that there's cameras everywhere, people are watching you, it's not what you think it is, like your world's fake.
Everything I've told you is the truth. It's fake. It's all for you.
She's trying to lead him out of that. It's her in his life that is the cause for him to start, like, the true path. Because he was kind of not sure until he got confirmation from her.
Yeah, she sort of initiates the whole thing falling apart.
She, in Truman's life, was like a high school love that was like Truman's first love. And this kind of reminds me of a couple things, of course, because it's another female character in Adam's life named Zoe that teaches him how to kind of redeem himself and ascend.
Sylvia seems a little bit like all of those divine feminine Gnostic figures. And even in the Gnostic texts, they sort of flow in and out of each other in a way that suggests they're all kind of cut from the same fabric. They're all related. They're emanations of each other. They're allies on this mission.
Right. And we've said, you know, this whole Gnostic idea is ultimately based off of the Nag Hammadi text, which, to be specific about the potential group of people who wrote it, were probably Sethian Gnostics. And it's therefore like a Sethian creation myth. And in the text itself, it mentions the idea of Barbello, which is like this father, mother, but ultimately a female ingredient to, I guess, the Holy Trinity, where it's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Instead of the Holy Spirit, it would be like a mother figure with full-on symbolism being involved. And that's why, like, the Barbie movie probably makes a lot of sense, being Barbello, Barbie. It's just telling me that it's kind of the same idea from a female-empowered perspective.
Barbie's funny about it because Barbie's obviously a woman, but she's also a bit hermaphroditic in her own way.
I'd like to inform you, I do not have a vagina. And he does not have a penis. We don't have genitals.
Ugh. Now, Sylvia is Lauren Garland's real name. All three names are exquisite hints, as this is confirmation, at least for me, that she is the Dickian dark-haired woman who is also cognate to the divine feminine personages whose speckle Gnostic cosmology that we just discussed. Etymologically, Lauren can be traced to the laurel tree, and by extension, the laurel leaf, which was used to symbolize victory or accomplishment in the ancient Greek world. After all, it was Nike, the goddess of victory, who would crown the victor with laurel wreaths. For this reason, wisdom is also an attribution, as the laurel wreath is still commonly used to symbolize academic achievements, as it was in Greek culture, which produced the idea of the liberal arts in the first place. This crown is, specifically speaking, an arrangement of flowers, which is appropriately referred to as a garland. These various associations all find their proper home, Kabbalistically speaking, in the sphere of Netzach, whose name itself means victory, and whose planetary association is Venus, the goddess of love, the only deity capable of nullifying the civic, karmatic, and legal obligations associated with Jupiter and Saturn in Greek myth. This idea survives into our modern day with the aphorism, all is fair in love and war. Venus, after all, can be traced back to Inanna Ishtar, both of which were Semitic war deities, which all considered makes sense why she would act to crown the victorious. Duh. As reflected in the Kabbalah, this makes her fundamentally different from a fertility deity who would be more fitting of lunar symbolism, which we will discuss at some depth very shortly. Venus as a lover, at least according to Kabbalistic and ancient Roman conceptions, was good at her art of love precisely because her craft extended into literature, philosophy, science, conversation, and art. After all, we find Lauren Garland appears to Truman in an academic setting and reveals him the truth of his situation inside of a library. At least she begins to in the library. Eventually, she reveals that Lauren is merely her character name on set. Her real name is Sylvia, a name which means spirit of the wood. This is where the Gnostic manuscript we discussed last week will come in handy, as spirit of the wood may be a reference to Eve in the hypostasis of the Archons. In the hypostasis, Eve is taken from Adam's side, but unlike Adam, she's endowed not just with a body, but a spirit, which seems to act independently of her body. This may be represented in the film by this character having two names. In the Gnostic creation myth, it is Eve who awakens Adam from the sleep that the Demiurge has placed over him. As she's speaking with Adam, just as in the Truman Show, the Archons become agitated with great agitation and begin to pursue her. Just as in the film, the Archons Leprechauns chase her for a while unsuccessfully. When they do eventually catch up to her in the hypostasis, Eve turns herself into a tree, leaving behind only a shadowy reflection of herself. Likewise, Spirit of the Wood is a fitting name for a character who, mythologically, is Adam's spirit and has taken the form of a tree. In the hypostasis of the Archons, she also moves her spirit into a serpent, which opens the couple's eyes to the reality of their enslavement, just as Sylvia does with Truman on the beach. In the Gnostic manuscript, Eve leaves behind only a shadowy image of herself for the Archons to defile, just as the memory of Sylvia is defiled by the Archons on the Truman Show. To take this a bit further, just as Noria of the hypostasis is transposed into Nama in the Zohar, Truman is told by the Archons that Sylvia is nothing but a pathological seducer of men.
Like when her, quote, father shows up and says, oh, she takes all her boyfriends out here. Oh, she's done this before. You should just ignore what she said to you. And then when she's taken away, she sheds a shadow version of herself, which is the cardigan.
Right.
That he tries to give back to her, but ultimately that's left behind as a reflection or reminder of that interaction.
Exactly. And then there's a smear campaign that's like, oh, she's just a slut. She's a seducer. She's like the creator of all the demons, which is how that same personage gets treated in Jewish mysticism. Now, after defiling Eve's shadow in the hypostasis, the text says the following.
And they defiled the stamp of her voice, so that by the form they had modeled, together with their own image, they made themselves liable to condemnation.
I believe a wink and a nod to this exact line comes during the scene when Sylvia calls Christoph live on air, which allows her to publicly condemn the show in a dialogue between the two. Christoph even initiates the conversation by saying, I remember that voice. Then, condemnation of the show continues years after Truman's initial encounter with Sylvia because he, unable to gaze upon her directly, models her face using images provided to him by the Archons from various beauty magazines, which continually reminds the viewer of this cruel ordeal.
The beauty magazines being made of paper may even suggest that this is the tree that his Eve has turned into.
And these criticisms have not gone unnoticed by the masses either, as Sylvia seems to be part of, or is perhaps even leading, a banner-waving bunch of protesters called the Free Truman Movement. This would be appropriate for the Venus archetype, whose Kabbalistic god name is Sabaoth, a name which means army, and features in the hypostasis as one of the Archons who rebels against and eventually overcomes the Demiurge.
Well, I definitely got a Sophia vibe from Sylvia, especially with the red cardigan Truman kept, down to the button that said, how will it end? Which really reminds me of that certain lady in a red dress riding the beast, ushering in the apocalypse. She tells Truman about the exit so the illusion can all end, and so he's free to start a new life as he wills it, not what his selfish father wants, Christoph, who literally treats him like a slave.
I think you're dead on the money relating how will it end to biblical revelations. Revelations, after all, means revealing. Once the truth is revealed to Truman, the show is over. Sylvia, in this regard, is absolutely the whore of Babylon, the outside world, and a harbinger of the show's apocalypse.
She is the embodiment of wisdom that lures him and guides him towards the ultimate goal. Truth, love, attraction at first sight, and feelings of fate cannot be stifled, even by the most elaborate illusions and noise. Above all else, he wanted to know her, and also figure out what the heck was going on. This urge to meet with Sylvia and go to the ends of the earth to find her in Fiji, and understanding that truth of what she was talking about, was his calling to Sophia, or wisdom.
In terms of being a spirit of truth, she's the only real thing that ever happened to him inside the show. The Gnostic spin is that her transgressions are what make her sacred.
I think it's also, they reference it again, and they use it as a distraction in kind of the same way that The Matrix does with the lady in red.
Yes.
Because when they're trying to introduce a new love interest to Truman, they try and distract him with, what was her name? Vivian. And she's in red.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, oh, you want the lady in red? Here's a lady in red. It's like, no, that's not the true one.
It's like, mom, we want the lady in red. Mom's like, we have the lady in red at home. Lady in red at home, Vivian.
And just this very idea of, if Truman is Tifereth and the sun and the solar entity on the show, there is a woman involved in his life. That's the true moon. But in the show, in the Truman Show, there is in fact a big fake moon that is very central to the whole story.
Yeah, it's where all the Archons are residing. That's where the Demiurge lives. That's where his flunky Archons reside and follow his orders. And from what we can tell, they actually live on the moon in that command station, because you see him getting up in the morning and exercising and eating breakfast and drinking coffee, etc.
Yeah, it's like the main brain of Truman's Matrix is all housed in the moon.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Right, because you want something to overshadow the true moon and project this false moon that is misguiding Truman to the truth beyond, the world that he's in inside of his show. It's keeping him trapped in, and it's doing a really good job. There's a really cool Tool song that's called Reflection, and the song starts off with the line, "The moon tells me a secret." And I think it's definitely applicable here, because if he was to truly look at what the moon that is projected in his world is, he would see the show is all fake in one step. Like, if he got on a rocket ship and landed on the moon in his world, he would find it very quickly that it wasn't what it was supposed to be.
Which makes me very suspicious, because as we've discussed on the show, the real-life moon is absolutely the strangest thing in our solar system. Like, almost everything about it is a little wrong, and it makes you wonder, what secrets does the moon have? At one point, Truman and his best friend Marlin are sitting on a sandbank watching the moon. The lightning flashes over the water, but you can actually see these lightning flashes reflecting off the surface of the moon, which is hinting that it's really not as far away as it's advertising itself to be.
I also noticed during the sunset scenes when he's sitting on the beach watching it with, you know, I think Marlin at one point and then by himself at another, that the moon didn't have cycles because it seemed to be backlit. It didn't reflect the sun in a natural way at all, like in a crescent shape as it should be if it was next to the sun. To me, it made everything seem kind of off, kind of like a negative break through the fourth wall, or when you can subtly tell that your favorite reality show is totally scripted and fake. I mean, the way that the Truman Show's set was structured reminds me a lot of Flat Earth, to be honest with you.
Oh, absolutely. That's what Flat Earthers literally believe.
Yeah, and you know, Truman, at the beginning of the film, he's living on Flat Earth. He's living like on Flat Malkuth, and he's looking at a flat world version of the moon, and therefore he's not able to penetrate any deeper into the Tree of Life.
Well, let's get into that. The moon becomes ultra important, especially from an esoteric perspective when we're talking about the deeper ideas in the film. It just honestly goes on and on. It actually brings us to one all-important name in the film. Kristoff. Now, Kristoff is the Scandinavian edition of Christopher, which is totally germane to his role in the film, as the name itself means Christ bearer, like he holds the Christ. He contains the Christ child, in this case, the true man. He raises him and protects him from the dangers of the real world. After all, it is Kristoff who keeps Truman separated from Earth as he operates or directs the Truman Show from his command station on the moon. This is an important detail because, just like the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, it is the Sephiroth of the moon called Yesod, which separates Tifereth, the realm of the true man, from the earthly domain in Malkuth.
Truman, no! That's off limits!
Why? What's over there?
Nothing! Dangerous, that's all.
On the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, the sphere of Yesod is sometimes even referred to as the staging ground, or even a miniature of the real earthly world below it in Malkuth. As such, the name Yesod means foundation. This is so after the film, it's difficult knowing which part to even unpack first. For starters, Sea Haven is a miniature edition of the real world. One that Kristoff explains is only different in so much as it is perfected. It's safe. It's uniquely tuned for the benefit of Truman's existence. This lines up exquisitely with what Kabbalist Dion Fortune describes of the sphere of Yesod in her seminal work, Mystical Kabbalah.
Yesod, then, must be conceived of as the receptacle of the emanations of all the other Sephiroth, as it is taught by the Kabbalists, and as the immediate and only transmitter of these emanations to Malkuth, the physical plane. As the Yetzeratic text says, it is the function of Yesod to purify the emanations and to prove and correct them. Consequently, it is the sphere of Yesod that all operations are carried out which are designed for the correcting of the sphere of dense matter, or in any way to dispose of its unity of design. Yesod, then, is the all-important sphere for any magic which is designed to take effect in the physical world.
I must say, Dion Fortune's discussions on anything with Yesod, Yetzirah, or the moon, it's always so good.
I love Mystical Kabbalah. If you want to learn more about the Kabbalah on this level, just pick up the book and read the whole thing.
If you want to start somewhere on the complicated Kabbalah stuff with the Q, not with the K or C, Dion Fortune, her work is great.
So if we dumb down the language a notch from where Dion Fortune had it, she's essentially saying that Yesod receives the energies of all the other Sephiroth, refines, perfects, and combines them into a cohesive whole, which is then basically 3D printed into the material world that you and I enjoy. The mundane expression of this in the film is how the Truman Show, lacking in full-length commercials, compensates for this by turning the entire setting of Sea Haven into a shopping catalog.
Oh my god, I love the product placement, though.
It's very honest in how we do things today. Well, how does this pertain to Yesod? Well, the things that are first seen on the Truman Show, or what eventually becomes a tangible product, in the outside world on a more esoteric level, because Yesod assembles pieces into a cohesive whole before being born into existence. Yesod can best be understood as a womb. Even the name Sea Haven is the perfect analogy for a womb, an organ defined by its capacity as a chamber of watery protection, explicitly tasked with building up a physical body over time. This is reflected in the planetary body manifesting in four distinct phases, which appear to grow and shrink predictably while the sun, the source of its light, remains relatively constant. These four phases are waxing, full, waning, and new. Truman hinted this idea with his motto, good morning, and if I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Oh.
Yes.
That's a good take on that.
I believe it's meant to express that while Truman is the star or sun of the show, he is firmly contained within the womb-like realm of the moon, subject to its orderly cycles of increase and decrease. And if you listen to what Dion Fortune says about it, she says, like, there's this idea of the four elements with a fifth that governs it. And she's like, well, Malkuth is the four elements, and then Yesod is like the spirit of that. And then she's like, Yesod itself has like four phases like the moon, and then Tifereth, the sun, is like the spirit of those four phases. So it's like...
I was kind of banging my head against the wall. I was like, why is that Truman's last words? I think this is a very accurate Kabbalistic take on it.
Now, this motif, it's also present in The Matrix, which etymologically is related to both the words mother and matter, which are cognate to Yesod's generative womb-like properties. Likewise, for the womb to accomplish its only purpose, everything must be perfectly organized. Everything must be in its correct place at the correct time. Each character has a certain marker or role to play in maintaining the womb. When something is out of place, it must be quickly and ruthlessly corrected, or the entire build-out may fail catastrophically.
Like how when his dad, the actor snuck back in that played his dad, it was just standing around like a homeless dude.
Yep.
And as soon as he recognized him and they embraced, he was pried away and pulled away into a bus and like whisked off with no explanation.
Yeah, they just collected him, pooped him out. And that's basically what a womb does. And even later in the film, Christoph is talking to his archons. He's like, if Truman does something unpredictable, you need to come tell me immediately. And this is why. Now, in The Matrix, this corrective role is played by Agent Smith, as his name is reflective of this capacity for building and correction. The nail that sticks up gets hammered down. In The Truman Show, however, this role is played by Marlon.
I love Marlon. He's the beer product placement. You know, he's the beer product placement ad. He's always drinking that six pack. That's the comfort item that he brings to like bro it out with Truman.
That is a beer.
For me, he's the creepiest part of the film because, I don't know, there's something eerily real about his character.
Yeah, it's Truman's best friend. Truman's like in distress and he goes straight to Marlon, and Marlon's like, man, you're crazy, dude. You know what? Let's just drink and like, yeah, have a good time. Like, it's the worst. It's like his direct enemy, because every time Truman's like looking for help, it's like, no, not that guy. Oh.
Like, I felt that way too, Truman. You need to settle down and just calm down and have a beer with me. Like, like, don't go looking for more satisfaction. It's okay to settle into your mediocre life here. Like, I couldn't believe that he was just straight-faced telling him that.
But straight up, that's what friends actually do. That's why super successful people are like, you should only hang out with people that are more successful or inspired than you are so you could get up to their level. Don't hang out with people that want to drag you down, because misery loves company.
And that's all anyone in the show ever does to him. Even when he talks about Fiji with his wife, she's just like, oh, well, you know, we're supposed to just settle down and have a baby. Like, there's nothing out there. We're perfectly happy here. Why don't you just stay here? And then Marlon just keeps doing the same thing, too. Like, if he really cared about Truman, he would tell him to go find the truth.
Yeah, I feel like if he was really Truman's friend, he would have at some point said something.
Agree.
Now, Marlon's name etymology, it might even be more brilliant than Agent Smith's. In fact, we actually have discussed Marlon's name etymology on the show before in our episode about, well, Finding Nemo, where the character with the same name is also preoccupied with finding reasons to never let the protagonist leave the safety of home.
Whoa.
Now, Marlon is the perfect name for this character archetype from Welsh origin. Marlon derives from Merdin, which means sea fortress. Besides having an uncanny similarity to the etymology of Burbank, it also implies a womb by combining the idea of water, holding, and protection. In the German language, Marlon is the conjunction of Maru for famous and Land for land, an apt description of Sea Haven, the setting for the world's most famous show. Then, from Romanian origin, Marlon is said to originate with Marcus and means dedicated to Mars, which makes sense because, mythologically speaking, Mars is the archetypal bro with a shield. Throughout the film, Marlon demonstrates over and over that's his primary concern for Truman, to keep him within the protective confines of the sea fortress slash womb of Sea Haven.
Boom.
In short, he shields Truman from the outside world.
I also remember, too, when he first met eyes with Lauren or Sylvia, who was distracting him. Marlon was there blowing his trumpet in Truman's face while he was trying to make eyes with his girl.
Oh, you're right. He was shielding him.
Yep.
From a Kabbalistic perspective, Mars is also associated with the Sephiroth of Gevura, which means severity, although in some versions, it's named Pachad, which means fear. On the Tree of Life, the Sephiroth is both protective and eliminative. It separates and removes influences that would threaten the whole. Unlike the spectacularly violent Agent Smith, Marlon mostly performs this function in the psychological domain by helping destroy, separate, or push ideas out of Truman's head, most readily the ones which suggest he should try to leave. This idea of separation is further emphasized by the more obvious interpretation of his name vis-a-vis a Marlon being, well, a swordfish. Sword, or Zayn in the tarot, is associated with the Lover's card, whose original title was either the Twins, or perhaps even the Brothers, representing the archetypal pair of Cain and Abel. This relationship to Truman seems fairly straightforward, as we've demonstrated the similarity in name etymology and the motto shared by the inseparable duo.
We were right together, and we were wrong together.
Unlike Cain, though, he really is his brother's keeper. Naturally, Zayn, the Hebrew letter associated with the Lovers, means sword, and is strongly associated with the idea of separation in the Hebrew language. Next, the fish, in swordfish, can easily be related to the death card whose Hebrew letter association is Nun, which itself means fish. Okay, so what does that have to do with anything? Well, the zodiacal association with the death card is Scorpio, which is also associated in alchemy with the stage of separation, the exact thing Marlon does for Truman as he helps sift through his various thoughts. This is usually accomplished by swooping in on his big red truck with cans of beer. After all, the womb is a place of rest, and alcohol is the perfect tonic to keep someone blissfully asleep, complacent, and suggestible.
I just wanted to say, in reference to the Mars relationship, he really is like the martial enforcement of the law. He's the foot soldier that is hands-on.
Oh, yeah, he's actively, like, manipulating Truman.
He's the one that, like, is actively enforcing it, like a soldier doing what he's told, like a martial soldier.
And, like, when they are unsure and need to check on him, he's the first person they send. It's not his wife. It's not his neighbor. It's nobody else except for Marlon. And he's sent into the front lines to put hands on Truman and make sure that he's still there or okay.
Well, I'm afraid to chuck another tarot card at the audience over Marlon. I cannot help but see these symbols coming together in the Chariot. After all, the zodiacal association with the Chariot is Cancer, the crab who is, of all things, ruled by the moon, just as Marlon is ruled by the Archons in the false moon. Traditionally speaking, this combination of symbols in the Chariot, the moon, the armored crab, and the protective vehicle of conveyance is also cognate to the idea of a womb. Trucks are designed specifically for holding material, and the redness of Marlon's truck may indicate the shell of a crab, albeit one who's already been cooked. In the Thelemic edition of the tarot, this concept of the womb is symbolized further by the charioteer holding a red grail. Considering Marlon always shows up with beer, this is likely the hidden meaning. Some additional evidence I have for this theory is that Marlon's license plate on his red truck begins with 6, 8, 9. The 6 and the 9 create the Cancer symbol, while the 8 in the middle is the numerical value of the Hebrew letter of the card, Chet, which means fence, and reinforces Marlon and the Chariot's purpose to put a protective fence around the baby being grown.
Don't you ever get antsy? Itchy feet.
Where's there to go?
In one scene, we even see Marlon wearing a hat that says FWD or four-wheel drive.
Despite all these various attributions and symbols, the meaning is always the same. Marlon represents the active, protective, and eliminative agent of the lunar womb, the same way Agent Smith does in The Matrix. His job is to protect Truman from the outside world at any cost.
It's also kind of interesting because, like, Truman is obviously inspired to move by the divine feminine representation of Sophia in Sylvia. And he, Marlon, shows up constantly with beer, which is also like spirit. It's a divine feminine iteration, like a distraction, like drink away your problems. Kind of like this underlying, like, oh, you're thinking about that. Well, here, have this other version be sufficed.
It's a solid replacement.
Yeah.
Because if we're talking about Sylvia being like a woods spirit, it also kind of invokes Pan, also this kind of drunkenness off of nature. But in this version, it's a woman getting drunk off of love, and a woman and ultimate truth, true union for Truman. Truman versus like, okay, well, we're just going to replace it with beer. And it's a total product placement scenario there.
Not going to lie, I wanted to try the beer.
Of course.
Nice. Right,
let me just collect my thoughts for a second.
Can you keep the burp in, Luke?
Okay. Mal, are you drinking beer?
Oh, I'm trying to not remember the next couple days because I'm sad. But I'm here. And, you know, we're talking about booze, so I'm getting sauced up. And the movie has a very poetic way of climaxing the point of the womb being a safe place. But the womb itself invokes an idea of a new birth. And Truman, by the end of the movie, he sails on a boat. He overcomes a fear of water, which is all like feminine aligned in itself. And he gets to a point where he finds a doorway that we don't know what's beyond it. It's complete darkness. And it's like a womb where he's becoming another version of himself. It's almost blatant, like crossing of the abyss, but it's also like the womb. It should be viewed as like a dark void of sorts that anything can manifest out of, like chaos. The womb is wet and it's primordial and unmanifested. And Truman is the true man, but he has merely stepped out of the first like level of true understanding on what it means to be alive. I think it's very beautiful that he's in the middle of the ocean and actually touching the firmament of the sky itself, which is like invoking Nuit, and then opening a door in that, and there's not even light beyond that point. It's just a pure black pit, which in itself is like feminine. So he's diving into this alchemical integration of that. He's the sun finally realizing this doorway past the firmament and coming to an ultimate truth, and it's an interesting ending.
But I mean, I would even say that even Seahaven and that whole world, the stage, that is also a womb. I mean, it's a false womb. To me, the outside world would be like being born into the actual real world that we all live in. And yeah, it could be, from his perspective, it is the void. It's almost like he's an adult and he is just now coming out of the womb as a real person.
And it's wet. He's in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Like it's very like
the water broke on top of him. He passed out, and then like he broke the wall like with the boat, and then he finally finds the door and he's able to leave the womb.
A baby.
Yeah, I mean, it is really like you're watching his birth, even though he's already been born technically. This is his true birth because now he gets to live his own life by his own will.
But if you'd like to hear more about wet wombs, at least as they're described in the tarot and the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, along with what it has to do with the Truman Show, why did a Parcan light with the label Sirius fall from the sky, and the magical devices that Truman used to finally escape his prison in the Truman Show, along with his final attainment, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended edition of this episode, but all the extended editions of all of our episodes going back before the 20s. I'll even send you a 5x5 high quality black vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll be given the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can discuss the hidden symbolism in your favorite Gnostic films, or ask questions about magic, or talk about your cat, because that's what happens a lot. We like cats. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.